Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, July 1st. With us now, Princeton Distinguished University Professor Eddie Glaude, who has a new book called Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. Professor Glaude, it's always great to have you on. Congratulations on the book, and welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's always great to talk with you, Brian.
I was wondering if you could start with your professor's hat on, I guess, at kind of a James Baldwin 101, because many listeners have heard the name, know that he's a giant in literary and other ways, mid and late 20th century, but not that much more. So where would you start to introduce the totally uninitiated to who James Baldwin was and why he was and remains important?
You know, so first I would say he was born on August 2nd, 1924, passed away December 1st, 1987, born in Harlem. And born to parents who migrated from the South, and wasn't in Sugar Hill. He grew up in a poor side of New York City, and that shaped how he saw the world. Was a child preacher, and was seen as precocious in some ways. Struggled with his sexuality in his early years, and struggled with his father. But then realized that if he stayed in the United States, he would, as he put it, he would either kill someone or be killed. So he decided to leave, and he packed up and went to France, and there engaged in this extraordinary effort to make himself into a writer, and he did so by writing this extraordinary book entitled "Go Tell It on the Mountain," producing essays that later were collected as Notes of a Native Son. And became, in some ways, Brian, one of the most insightful interpreters of American life from its underside. I like to read him as a figure who is an inheritor of Emerson, but he brings Emerson across the tracks. But Baldwin lived long enough to participate in the civil rights movement, found himself not only raising money, but also risking his life. In one biography, he's actually said to have joined the CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, and SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He lived long enough to see the assassination of Medgar Evers and Malcolm X, and, of course, eventually Dr. Martin Luther King. And in some ways, the death of King, he fell to pieces. He collapsed. Actually tried to commit suicide in 1969, one of many times, actually. And found himself trying to come to terms with America's latest betrayal, only to take his last breath in St. Paul de Vence in France, and gave us over 7,000 pieces of writing.
Wow.
One of America's amazing, amazing artists.
Let's dig in more on that period you were just talking about. Before and after the death of King, but in that period, because you write about that time between two of his major works, The Fire Next Time in 1963 and No Name in the Street in 1972, as a period when Baldwin changed in some important ways, a period you call the after times. So can you talk a little bit about that term and what James Baldwin Baldwin was experiencing in those years?
Yeah, Brian, you know, after times, I take that phrase from Walt Whitman's Democratic Vistas. And Whitman is trying to figure out what the country is doing in the after the carnage of the Civil War and the collapse of Reconstruction. He sees the Gilded Age on the horizon, that the country is making changes, is moving, but it's lost its soul. So it's kind of a period of interregnum, right, where something is collapsing, an old world is dying, a new world is trying to be born, but the ugly forces are arresting substantive change. So Baldwin's after times is really, you know, the country had turned its back on the civil rights movement. You saw that when they killed what he called, you know, described King as the apostle of love. Baldwin had seen the idealism of the young people that he encountered at Howard, who were foot soldiers in SNCC, who risked everything to change the country nonviolently. And he saw them, their eyes darken, how they got enraged, how, you know, a kind of realistic politics, right, took hold, where they gave They left aside the moral question and understood power as the principal object of concern. We saw the country literally turn its back, betray its ideals, turn its back on us again. And so he had to try to figure out how to pick up the pieces. He collapsed, man, trying to figure out what to do. And he had to, in some ways, leave the country again and ended up in Istanbul in order to kind of offer a language to describe the moment of how we might endure this moment and still be able to imagine America otherwise.
So do you see today as after times in ways that are parallel to the late 60s and early 70s for Baldwin, maybe after Obama to Trump or in any other way?
Exactly. You know, that's exactly why I found myself reaching for him. You know, everyone was talking about, you know, that America had turned the corner with the election of Obama in 2008. Many of us knew that that was hyperbole, but we understood it. Some of us were disappointed in those 8 years, and we wrote about it. But, you know, the country began to respond in a way, you know, with the vitriol of the Tea Party, claiming economic anxiety, but we knew it was driven by racial anxiety. We saw states and passing voter ID laws and voter suppression running rampant across the country, and then we vomited up Donald Trump. And, you know, this call, this nostalgia, take America back, make America great again, right? The longing for an America of the 1950s. So we were in our aftertimes, this moment where the country seemed to be on the precipice of profound change, but we were doubling down on our ugliness again. And so it felt a sense of betrayal, a sense of disillusionment and despair in that moment. And I had to figure out how to think about and how to act, actually, in light of my rage and my despair and a faith that we could be otherwise. Because Jimmy, in his darkest moments, in his deepest moments of despair, he still held on to the belief that we could make what he called a New Jerusalem.
Hmm. So, Professor Claude, what did you decide to read for us?
You know, there's a piece that's so important to me entitled "The Artist's Struggle for Integrity," written in 1963. And I'll just jump into it. He says, "You're bearing witness helplessly to something which everybody knows and nobody wants to face, least of all the hypocritical or the hypothetical misfit who has not learned how to walk or talk and doesn't know enough about experience to know what experience he has had. Well, one survives that no matter how. By and by, your uncles and your parents and church stop praying for you. They realize it won't do a bit of good. They give you up, and you proceed a little further, and your lovers put you down. They don't know what you're doing either, and you can't tell them because you don't know. You survive this, and in some terrible way, which I suppose no one can ever describe, you are compelled, you are corralled, you are bullwhipped into dealing with whatever it is that hurts you. And what is crucial here is that if it hurts you, that is not what's important. Everybody's hurt. What is important, what corrals you, what bullwhips you, what drives you, torments you, is that you must find some way of using this to connect you with everyone else alive. This is all you have to do with it. You must understand that your pain is trivial, except insofar as you can use it to connect with other people's pain. And insofar as you can do that with your pain, you can be released from it, and then hopefully it works the other way around too. Insofar as I can tell you what it is to suffer, perhaps I can help you suffer less."
Thank you. Do you want to say a word about, I mean, it's self-explanatory, I guess, but about why that speaks to you so much?
You know, suffering is the bridge, you know? There's so much about the categories that define our lives, that constrain and box us in, whether it's black, white, straight, queer, gay, woman, man, however we want to describe these categories. And oftentimes those categories do all the work for us so that we can't see the complex human being sitting right in front of us, standing right in front of us. But our suffering can be a bridge, right? It connects us. And Jimmy is always reaching for the ground, the condition under which we can imagine ourselves differently. We can break loose from, you know, those shackles, those thongs, those Oedipus thongs that are wrapped around our ankles. And here, this is so important for me because it threw me back on to my own struggles with my own father and how why it was so difficult to write this damn book and survive it, you know?
DeForest in Yonkers. You're on WNYC with Professor Eddie Glaude. Hi, DeForest.
Hi. Professor Glaude, it's just magnificent listening to you, and I'm glad you get that book. I'm going to rush out and get me a copy just as soon as I can. I had a brief solitary encounter with James Baldwin in the years just before I think he passed. It was at the Ethical Culture Society in Manhattan on 64th Street. And I remember him talking among a number of things about the kind of sadness that he felt at the betrayal of America, not just at the betrayal of America for black people, but the betrayal of America for all people, and the lie that America continues to tell all over the world about what it is when it clearly is not that. And so at the close of the session, I asked him, because the story about how shall we sing from the Bible that said, how shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? And I came up behind him and I asked him as he was about to leave, I said, Mr. Baldwin, I said, how shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? How shall we sing those songs? And he turned around with those big bulbous eyes and he kind of gazed at the ceiling. And then he said to me, I don't know. And then there was a pause. And then he said, but I simply know we must.
Yeah.
Wow. And it was that we must thing that it seems to me that what it is that you are talking about, that that we as a people have turned the bowels of the pig and the weeds in the garden into culinary masterpieces, that they whip us and that we sing a kind of blues that unites the whole world, that there is something magnificent about the way that we have decided to use the worst that America has given to us to unearth our best, that those pressures have turned us into a kind of a diamond that the whole world knows about. We don't know that they know about them because we sometimes think that we are all alone by ourselves. But when the Berlin Wall was coming down, they were singing, we shall overcome. So people do pay attention, and we need to pay attention. And just thank you so much for that, Brother Glaude.
No, thank you. Thank you for that powerful story. My goodness.
Wow.
DeForest, right on point.
Please call us again. Eric in Middletown, you're on WNYC with Professor Eddie Glaude. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Brian. Good morning. Professor Glaude, thank you so much. I love listening to you whenever you're on the Sunday talk shows, pushing back in a wonderful way. As a kid who grew up in Jersey in the 70s and 80s, you know, I thought of myself as a pretty well-read individual and you know, wanted to think of myself that way, read a lot of the classics. And a lot of those classics always came from this, you know, sort of systemic view of what is insightful, what matters. And I came to Baldwin way too late in my life. And when I read Another Country, Giovanni's Room, I could not believe that a man had such piercing insight, but could wrap it in such a beautiful poetic turn of phrase. There were times where I had to just stop reading because I couldn't believe the sentence I just read. And so just to make a point about my own prejudice, my own racism, I know I am an unintentional, well-meaning racist, and a lot of that comes from this sort of systemic, unseen, here's what's valuable, here's what isn't. Oh, you know, African-American blues and music, yeah, well, it's great rhythm, but it's not something intellectual. All this sort of nonsense that I'm too late in my life coming to really see as everything I need to reexamine every day. And my final point really is just, you know, I really don't want to be a white, fragile guy. I want to ask the hard questions and engage in those conversations where someone might turn around and say, dude, that's really racist what you just said. And instead of being like, no, I'm not, I really want to say, yeah, racism is inside my bones and I want to learn how to exercise it. So anyway, Professor Glaude, I'm going to run out and get that book. Thank you so much for writing it. I can't say enough about James Baldwin.
Eric, thank you very much. Professor, anything you'd like to say about Eric?
You know, it's never too late. It's never too late. And I think he touched upon something that begins the book, actually. I talk about the lie and how the lie distorts and disfigures not only our national self-conception, but our own individual understanding of ourselves. And what we have to do is kind of unpack and undo the lie. And the lie is this belief that America is the shining city on the hill, this idea that America is the redeemer nation, right? And it's rooted in what Jimmy saw as the fundamental lie. When he said, when the country was founded, those people, when they saw us, they knew that they knew what a man was. They knew what a woman was, right? And I'm paraphrasing him here. But you know, when they saw us, they had to say that we were not men and women, right? Because to admit that we were was to, in effect, admit the crime. If we weren't, no crime was committed. Mm. And Jimmy says, that lie is the basis of our present trouble. All that follows from it. All of the discourse that follows from it. So I think trying to do that work, what you know, Wendell Berry talks about in The Hidden Wound, right, of grappling with how the language of racism, how whiteness takes root in us, how it works like language, he says about about himself. That ongoing work is part of what it means to make a distinction between being a white person and being someone who happens to be white.
Canadian Harlem. You're on WNYC with Professor Eddie Glaude. Hi, Kanani.
Hi, good morning, Brian. This is Kanani. I've called several times. I loved your show.
Thank you.
As you know, I do a show called Black Issues Issues. So I'm really interested to hear from Eddie, his analysis of the quote. Basically, James Baldwin said, to be black in America is to be in a perpetual state of rage. And so when I'm thinking about myself as a black person and how black women are distorted and they say, oh, you know, you're being angry, which again is another racism is a gaslight. But now that there is a multiracial movement, do you think that there's a critical mass of white people that are also enraged by racism? Or is it more the combination of pandemic, nothing else to do, no jobs, no, you know, and they're out there? Like, I mean, let's be honest. Thank you for laughing. I'm serious and silly at the same time. So I sincerely want to know, because I for me, my barometer is John Brown. If there's people out there that are either Nat Turner's and John Brown's in this movement, then I think we're going to see some change. Because when you're thinking about passing the budget like we just did in New York City, it's not an anti-racist budget. So we're basically by default still funding racism because we live in a city in a society of systemic racism. So all these budgets that are being passed are still funding racism. So I want to hear from you all. Like, do you think that this is like a John Brown, Nat Turner shift in the dialogue and the analysis of this experiment in democracy called America? Or is this more like another passing fantasy?
Kanani, thank you so much. Professor?
Well, we don't know. We can't make that judgment yet, right? It seems to me that I'm sure there's some out there who are enraged over racism. There's some who, I don't know if boredom would be the sufficient motivation to risk one's life with COVID-19 ravaging the country and the world. But I do think that there's a sense in which across the board, whether you're a millennial or Gen Zer or Gen Zoomer or however we describe it, there's a general conclusion that America is broken. That it's a generation that has come of age amid layered catastrophe, whether it's Hurricane Katrina, whether it's the Great Recession, whether it's mass school shootings, whether it's a global pandemic, whether it's climate change, whether, you know, whether it's, you know, student loan debt surpassing credit card. I mean, everything about our country at this point reveals that for 40 or 50 years of this economic, political, and social, that it's broken, it's bankrupt. And I think that's part of what we're hearing in the protest in the streets, along with, the protest against police brutality and cruelty. Baldwin is really insightful in this moment. To be black and conscious is to be in almost a perpetual state of rage. Why? Because, you know, there are the thousand cuts, as he mentioned in the debate with against William Buckley at Cambridge, the thousand cuts that happen daily that deny you dignity and standing, right? The thousand cuts daily that suggest to you that because of the color of your skin, you're less valued than others. The fact that some people get more opportunities to express their talents and fulfill their dreams, and you, right, have to scrape and scratch for one opportunity or two opportunities and the like. The fact that you have to worry about your babies as they go outside and just simply try to hang with their friends, and you don't know if they're going to come home because you don't know what someone in a uniform might think of them, right? It's a perpetual state of rage. And if you're not enraged, something must be wrong with you, it seems to me. It's just how you manage it and respond to it.
We have a few minutes left. You teach at Princeton, which just announced it's removing Woodrow Wilson's name from the School of Public Affairs. He's one of those who, for many Americans not steeped in enough history, they think Woodrow Wilson, he was a Democrat, he was a progressive in the League of Nations sense and on economics compared to Republicans of his era. President of Princeton, governor of New Jersey, didn't fight for the Confederacy. Can you give people a little Woodrow Wilson 101 in the context of this decision by the school, which I'm guessing that you support?
No, I definitely support. It's about time. Between the decision to remove Wilson's name from the School of Public Policy and Mississippi changing the state flag, I think, Brian, that hell is frozen over. I don't know. But it just seems to me that part of what Princeton is trying to do is to deal with the full complexity of Woodrow Wilson. Wilson is the first Southern president after the Civil War to be elected. He resegregates the federal government. He reintroduces a range of noxious assumptions about black folk, about women as well. And so there's a sense in which Wilson set the country back. He previews Birth of a Nation. In the White House, supposedly, and claimed that it was an extraordinary film. So what President Eisgruber has argued is that the nation has historically disregarded the effects of white supremacy and racism in the country, how we've disregarded the ways in which white supremacy have distorted and disfigured our basic values. And he said that Princeton has echoed that, or has imitated or duplicated that disregard in the very ways in which it has told the story of Woodrow Wilson. And so, you know, Princeton is often considered the Southern Ivy, Brian. So first black admit is 1945, right? Paul Robeson couldn't go to Princeton. He had to go to Rutgers. Princeton is also that spot, that site that James Baldwin, he hated Princeton, Eugene O'Neill as well. Baldwin was actually en route one in a restaurant, and the waitress refused to serve him, and he flung a glass at her and shattered the glass behind her and had to run for his life. But what Princeton is saying is that Woodrow Wilson and the period of Princeton history that he represented does not reflect the values of Princeton in this moment and the values of who we aspire to be. He will always be a part of history, a part of Princeton history. Princeton wouldn't be Princeton if it wasn't for him. But it means something to have him on the name of the School of Public Policy. It commends a certain set of values. And what I think the university community has concluded is that those values are not ours. We want to commend something else, something more commensurate with the community that we are and that we aspire to be.
Princeton Distinguished University Professor Eddie Glaud, who has a new book called Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. He will be in conversation online tonight at 7 o'clock with Cornell West. If you want to hear more, that's a virtual event, and you can get tickets via the link that we've put on our site. You can go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show for tickets to the virtual event with Eddie Glaud and Cornell West tonight at 7 o'clock. Professor Glaud, we appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Always. Thank you, Brian. Appreciate you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is obviously also a Daily Coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.